Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And today we're going to take another look back on an older episode. You see, we got a lot of news about the Oculus Rift that's been piling up since March of 2014. And we did an episode called The Oculus Rift Story as the story so far. So there's enough information to kind of update that, but not so much that we can do a whole new episode.
Right. That original episode published on August 21st, 2013, if you want to. Well, you don't need to go looking for it.
Because we're about to play it.
We're about to play it. However, just to give you an idea in the timeline of where this occurred.
Yes. So since August 2013, a lot has happened. So once we have played through that episode, stick around. We have a lot to say about what's been going on since then. So without further ado, here's the original episode.
Roll it, Noel.
Today we wanted to talk about something that technology that really made a big splash in late 2012 and really in 2013. Something that got a lot of people excited. I guess you could say it kick-started the virtual reality craze again in the U.S.
Oh my goodness.
The Oculus Rift.
So, yes, and as of June, they announced that they had just raised $16 million in private funding.
$16 million.
Which isn't shabby for a company run by a 20-year-old guy.
Okay, let's not focus on how young this guy is.
No, that's amazing. This is a tinkerer who is of the people. And
18 years younger than I am. Oy. Oy. Yeah, no, he really is, though. He's one of those guys who worked out of his garage messing with stuff that interested him and was able to leverage that into something that is really taking at least one section of the gaming world by storm. So we will be talking a lot about
video games, but in this case, it's a peripheral for video games. So all of you people out there who hate video game topics, this is still cool. It's virtual reality. Now, before we get into a discussion about Oculus Rift in particularly, I wanted to mention just sort of a history of virtual reality, kind of Jonathan's history of virtual reality. So this isn't in our notes or anything. This is from my own personal experience.
This is completely unofficial. He is making it up as he goes along. Well, dinosaurs will be involved.
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, yes. Well, technically, it's not a dinosaur. Pterodactyl's not a dinosaur, but it's close. So virtual reality, for those of you who were alive in the 90s and remember this kind of stuff, it started to really kind of get buzz in the early to mid 90s. This was one of those terms that was promising to turn computing on its head. It was changing the way we thought about computers. It was going to be immersive. You were going to be surrounded by the computer data. You would be part of this experience. It would no longer be this separation that was created by a screen and a keyboard and a mouse.
And this was partially due to science fiction.
It was largely due to science fiction, yeah.
because the actual technology at the time was not
up to par, not up to the expectations that were generated as a result of both science fiction. Also, I mean, obviously Hollywood had a big deal with how this was portrayed.
Absolutely,
and it was never really realistic in the Hollywood version. Also, if you watch any of those movies that had a lot of virtual reality elements to them, they look awful by today's standards. When you talk about the graphics quality.
Well, they were showcases of that early computer generated.
Right. But it was still, even though they look horrible by today's standards, they still looked amazing compared to what we were capable of doing with virtual reality at that time. Also, it was really expensive because this was all a technology that had to be built from the ground up specifically for the purpose of virtual reality. Now, here's a hard, cold fact about technology. If you're designing something that is brand new, as in no one has built this kind of stuff before, there's a huge amount of money that goes into that to build the
prototypes.
Research
and development.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm.
Enormous amount of money. And virtual reality did not, you know, it generated a lot of buzz, which was good in the early days. But then the reaction to what was actually possible was such that a lot of that interest and a lot of the support drained away very, very quickly. So you're left with these people who are doing valuable work in the field of virtual reality. But because there was this bubble that burst early on in the development of the technology itself and the industry, they were left with very little to work with once that bubble went away. So
also, I feel like at the time people were focused on the entertainment issues of it and weren't really thinking forward to the possible medical purposing and therapy purposing.
At least anyone outside the actual industry was not seeing that. You know, there were people who were working in the industry who actually saw some really cool applications, some of which we have actually seen happen over the course of the several years that have in between when virtual reality was a buzzword and today. But people who were looking at it from the outside, the general consumer, they were looking at it as video games.
Right.
Or sometimes, you know.
I think it got pigeonholed is all I'm saying.
Yeah. There was a smaller segment who were thinking virtual sex but I mean, those were like the two applications. It was either you were playing a game or you were having some sort of weird virtual romantic interlude.
Yeah. Yeah. That scene in Demolition Man happened. So
yeah.
That was a thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a thing.
If you haven't seen that, I don't necessarily recommend it.
It's, you know, for a
Wesley Snipes Sandra Bullock picture.
You know, it's fun. It's a fun film.
I'm not entirely anyway. Let
All right.
Us-
so anyway, getting back into virtual reality, so to speak. So as time went on, the virtual reality community began to really, like the people who were really working on trying to develop things like sophisticated head tracking technology, sophisticated display technology, and input, various user interfaces. What they began to do was they began to appropriate stuff from other industries, mostly the video game industry, because video games were progressing and they were starting to introduce new types of controllers. So, for example, when the Nintendo Wii launched, and they had the Wii control with the multiple axis gyroscopes in it, that allowed for very specific kinds of interaction with the console, the video or the virtual environment, by now it's called virtual environments, not virtual reality, because virtual reality had sort of a stigma attached to it. The virtual environment people were thinking, why don't we take that? Like, literally, we'll go out and buy a Nintendo Wii and take apart the controller and use the technology in the controller to help develop our stuff, because it's less expensive than developing one on our own or buying one of these very specific types of parts that are only made for virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of sets the scene for what happens with the Oculus Rift. So let's go and first we'll just talk about what the Oculus Rift is. It is a headset that has two screens in the headset, one screen for each eye.
Mm-hmm. The two screens both render a very similar image from a game.
Yeah. On casual glance, you would think that it's the same picture, but
they're from very, very slightly different angles.
Just like your eyes are.
Mm-hmm. To give the illusion of depth when your brain puts the two images together.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about what's actually going on there a little bit later in the podcast. So it's this headset and it has motion tracking. So essentially your head's motions are interpreted by hardware in this headset, sent to a computer that is taking that as input and then processing it within a game engine of some sort and sending back the response so that the images you see are based upon the movements you're making, right? I mean, that's basic head tracking technology, but it was this is what's interesting. To me, this is not new. Like I said, this started way back in the 90s, but a lot of the software side was very primitive. And so the pictures you would get would be very, very basic. Like when I said that whole pterodactyl thing, one of the early games was you're this blocky figure moving around a blocky landscape being chased by a blocky pterodactyl. And you had to just kind of run around and try and shoot other people using a blocky gun that fired, get ready for it, blocks. it was not that immersive. I mean, it was interesting that your head could move. It did track your motions, but it wasn't immersive in the sense that you felt anything was realistic. And there was a latency issue. And we'll talk about latency later, too. Latency is like the death sentence for virtual reality systems.
Yeah.
So this wasn't a new idea, but this was a new way of approaching it, and it was all made possible by other industries. It wasn't the fact that the virtual reality industry had advanced to a huge degree. It was because of things like smartphones and tablets. So let's talk about one of the most famous failures in virtual reality first, because this is one that the founder of Oculus, Palmer Luckey, has mentioned before, which is also from Nintendo.
Yeah, the Virtual Boy.
Back in 1996, this was one that the little headset would display red vector graphics. I think maybe not the first, but one of the first games to feature Wario was on the Virtual Boy. So he was able to survive the Virtual Boy, even if the product itself did not survive very long. Time Magazine gave it a review that was not positive. They actually said that that it was migraine inducing, and so there was a lot of bad press about the Virtual Boy, and it didn't sell terribly well. It was one of Tech's biggest flops.
I remember it being a blip on my radar, and then almost immediately disappearing.
Right up there with the Nintendo Power Glove.
Oh yeah.
If you had the Power Glove and a Virtual Boy, you are a huge Nintendo fan. You look like a cyborg, but you're probably throwing up a lot.
And you maybe had two games to play.
Yeah, that's also true. So Palmer Luckey, he looks back on this history of virtual reality, and he is absolutely fascinated by it and wants to get involved in it. But let's learn a little bit more about who he is first. Like you said, Lauren, he's 20 years old.
Right, as of right this very moment. He's from Irvine, California.
Mm-hmm.
He self-identifies as a hacker or maker.
Yep.
Both at the same time, probably. He was homeschooled. His dad's a car salesman, I believe.
Okay. He went to, as you know, he for school, for college, he was actually studying journalism.
Right.
He, in fact, said that one of the things he wanted to do, he was always interested in taking things apart and learning how they worked and then trying to put them back together. And, you know, he had kind of typical smart kid success rate at things still working when they were put back together after he'd taken them apart. But he said that he wanted to go to journalism school to learn to become a writer so that he could tell people, he could write articles, like really good articles, to explain how stuff works. He wanted my job. Palmer Luckey wanted my job.
Well, I'm really glad that he took his own job instead of ours.
Yeah, because we'd be out of a job and neither of us would have invented the Oculus Rift.
Fact.
Yeah, because his plan B ended up being a lot more successful.
Being pretty okay.
But
he was into some interesting pursuits as a child.
Yeah, yeah. Originally it was all about blowing stuff up.
Right.
Shocking stuff.
Yeah.
Or setting it on fire.
Like Tesla coil guns I read about somewhere.
Tesla coil guns. He built coil guns as a kid. He actually said in one interview, "It's a miracle I am still alive." Because he was building stuff like anything that would involve destruction through electronics was really fascinating to him. Typical kid.
Can't blame him. Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, probably like some little, I don't want to be an armchair psychologist, but in general, I notice that kids, and I don't separate myself from here, have occasionally power fantasies because so much of their life is
determined by other people.
Exactly.
Sure.
So this is sort of a self-determination, self-empowerment kind of thing. Some of us focus on dinosaurs because dinosaurs are bigger than our parents and therefore are more powerful. Some of us focus on Tesla coil guns that can melt our parents' faces off if we ever had that desire, which, by the way, he did not. Let's be clear. He was not planning on zapping people. He just
not
wanted to build stuff that did
us
cool things.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as far as we know.
But he did wind up doing something constructive as well. He started up an iPhone repair business, didn't he?
Yeah, he sure did. As a teenager, when the iPhone came out, he was fascinated with that. And immediately he took one apart and learned really what made it work. And so he, because of his practical knowledge of electronics that was, you know, largely self-taught, he ended up having a successful iPhone repair business. He also would jailbreak people's iPhones. So if they wanted to have an iPhone that could run other types of stuff on it that rather than just what Apple would allow you to run.
Yeah, dual boot with whatever.
Yeah. He would actually do that for a fee. And apparently it was pretty successful. So successful that he might have made around $36,000 in a single year doing this.
Wow.
Which, you know, as a teenager,
it's a pretty good salary.
Yeah,
humans, that's a pretty good salary.
For something like this is his version of a lemonade stand. That's a pretty successful lemonade stand.
Yes. As of 2009, when he was 16, I believe that was when he began looking into purchasing virtual reality equipment.
Yeah.
That's when he kind of had been online and had seen some stuff and was getting interested in the subject.
Right. And that was also, he's done interviews where he's talked about how the industry changed dramatically. Like, back in the early days, besides things like Nintendo's Virtual Boy, which were really the exception, those were there were only a few things that were ever consumer-based technologies that the average person would be expected to purchase.
Oh, right. Even today, a few years later, the very low-end virtual reality equipment runs around $1,000 a pop.
Yeah.
I think. And a lot of it, a lot of the more professional gear was running up near $100,000
a
pop.
In fact, one of the things he found a piece of virtual reality equipment that was pretty rare. And at the time it was first produced, cost $97,000. He bought it for $87.
Wow.
Because again, the VR industry just kind of petered out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was really interested to seeing how these things worked. How did they track head motion? How did they feed video in? And a lot of these early VR equipment pieces are enormous, right?
Sure.
They require things like
some kind of rig.
Exactly. They require a rig so that there's support, because if you were to just wear it yourself, it would be so heavy as to be uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them would be too heavy for you to even effectively move your head. So a lot of them would have these rigs that would allow you to have suspension from not the ceiling, but the rig itself would extend beyond where you would stand, and there'd be cords that would help support the weight of the helmet. So you wouldn't have full 360-degree motion either. If you were to try and turn all the way around, eventually those cords would start to wrap up.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you'd have to turn back the other way. So he was interested in purchasing as many of these as possible to learn what made them tick.
Yeah, he was thinking about creating more immersive game interfaces and experiences. But none of this stuff was really what he was looking for. He was kind of hoping to salvage something together for himself, honestly.
Right.
And none of it was working.
Right. So he learned a lot during this period.
Yeah. And as of 2011, he was working at the University of Southern California's Institute for Creative Technologies, which I believe is a military associated facility.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of the stuff they did was for the military.
Specifically, yeah. He was working in the virtual reality exposure therapy program, sometimes called Virtual Iraq, which helps veterans who have PTSD use VR therapy to get over their
post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah, in fact, this is one of the most fascinating uses for virtual reality. And I've actually talked to there are people over at Emory and there are people over at Duke who run labs that use this kind of approach.
Cool. Uh-huh.
And I've talked about it for use with PTSD. I've also talked about it for use with things like phobias. And the idea is it's this immersion therapy where you immerse a person into certain situations that might trigger anxiety or stress, but they know that they are in a safe environment. They know ultimately deep down that they are perfectly safe, that they are not really in that.
But it's immersive enough that for people who have a severe fear of flying.
Right.
I've heard that it's extremely successful.
Right. Something along the lines of you do a virtual visit to an airport. And the interesting thing here is that the scientists have discovered that the graphics do not have to be photorealistic at all. They don't have to be, to the point where you would look at something and think that's identifiable as Dulles International Airport, for example. You might look at it and just say, there's a building and there's the representation of a plane next to it. That's the airport. And once you get into the immersive environment, which usually takes around half a minute to a minute long for you to really get acclimated, assuming that everything is working properly on the technical end, then you start to have the actual physical reactions you would if you were in the real situation. So, for example, one about a fear of heights, I remember specifically reading about this, actually talking about this to some of the people at Duke and Emory. You might have a simulation where you're on the top of a tall building. The building does not necessarily look like a real building. I mean, it might look like almost a cartoonish example. But the person would start to have that same physiological response as if they were in the real situation. And it was part of this therapy to expose oneself to these situations in a safe environment to get acclimated.
It's the psychological principle of facing your fears, essentially. Yeah. There's a lot more technical terminology that we won't go into.
And there's
a lot
of other elements to this therapy, obviously.
Absolutely.
You don't want it to just be cruel and be like, hey, I heard you're scared of spiders. Here's a big hairy spider.
That's not
therapy. That's cruelty.
It's extremely guided therapy,
yes.
and there are many parts of it. But it's excellent, really interesting work.
Yeah, and so Lucky was working on this. This was part of the stuff that he was involved in, and he will be the first to tell you. By the way, he's a hardware guy. He's not a software guy.
Right.
And in fact, there's some great interviews that he's done with other members of the software community, of the video game community, where he says the success of the Oculus Rift, the early success it has had before it's not even a consumer product yet. As of the recording of this podcast,
it's in dev kit. There's developer kits that are out and that's about it.
Yeah. You cannot as a consumer buy this and expect to use it with a ton of games. Right now there are two games that are really
three as of this podcast.
Oh, okay. But, yeah. So a third one has recently joined
on. In the past week. Yeah.
But it's not like you can't plug it into your console either. This is PC only right now.
Mm-hmm.
With the hope that maybe one day it'll be available for multiple platforms. At any rate, he actually says point blank, he says the success of this would not exist without the software side, but that's not my world. I can't program. I can build this hardware. So, he really was using that expertise while working over at Southern California's Institute for Creative Technologies.
Right. And he threw, I think that he was a member of a couple forums, the names of which I am completely forgetting. So somebody write in and tell me, correct my complete lack of a word to give you.
Mr. Lucky. First of all, I object to have to call you Mr. You're 18 years younger than I am. But if you're listening, just write in and tell us what they were.
And he developed this plan to, you know, he really wanted to build a kind of a personal hobbyist kit of VR headsets.
Exactly. This was kind of a do-it-yourself.
So he planned a Kickstarter to just create 100 enthusiast kits.
Right.
You know, that you know, contributors would get the pieces of a virtual reality headset and put it together themselves and be able to play around with it. And but this got the attention of John Carmack.
Yeah. And if you don't know that name, then you haven't been playing a lot of id Software's games.
Yes. He's the co-founder of id Software. He was the lead programmer on, like, Wolfenstein 3D and Doom and Quake.
Love that game. That game's okay.
I was not,
I wasn't a very good Quake player. So, like, once multiplayer got introduced and I realized that, hey, people react very differently than computer controlled, bad guys, my kill death ratio was out the window. Ugh. What I'm saying is I'm not good at these games.
and furthermore, that you don't like games that you can't be better than other people at.
Oh, I hate that. That's just in general. By the way, if you ever have the opportunity to play a game with me, just turn it down. I'm including, like, board games, card games, maybe a role-playing game.
If you're playing Clue, do you just flip the table at some point?
Actually, I'm very good at Clue. I am really good at Clue.
But so he got the attention of John Carmack. And Carmack was kind of like, hey, so this is pretty cool. Could I buy one of these kits from you? And Lucky was like, I can give you one of those.
Right.
No problem. So Lucky sent him a prototype and Carmack just ran with it. He demoed it, with a Doom 3 BFG at 2012's E3.
Right. And that made everybody think, wow, I have never experienced Doom like this. This is a really immersive first-person shooter experience. The VR is working. It is exciting. Where can I get one of these?
Right. It exploded. And I mean, everyone was excited about it.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Yeah, so, you know, getting back to this idea of the developer kit 100 units, what that reminds me of is Wozniak and Jobs, because the very first Apple computer was essentially the same sort of thing. Like, we'll send you the parts, you build a case, and you've got yourself a computer.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Apple One.
Sure.
So that's exactly what Palmer Luckey was. He was like, this is going to be like a little side hobby for me. I'm going to do this. And at this point, where the press gets a chance to see it, and Carmack, he sees the potential for this well beyond a hobbyist, you know, tiny, tiny project. He sees this has potential to be a legitimate video game peripheral.
And this was a goofy prototype. I mean, I'm pretty sure that he was like duct taping straps to it so that people could demo it at E3. So.
Right, right. This was a little janky, as we like to say.
Yes, that is the technical professional term.
So what was Lucky's reaction to this sudden increase in interest and the possibility of actually having a feasible company as a result?
Basically, he dropped out of the journalism program at Cali State University.
Not a surprise. That's following in the footsteps of so many giants in the technology industry. By the way, stay in school, kids. Not all of us can be Palmer Luckey.
Right.
If you are Palmer Luckey, go ahead. But I mean,
if you have a genuinely terrific idea that has gotten someone of the ilk of John Carmack interested in you, then by all means,
pursue it. Run with it before you're shackled
with
life's responsibilities like I am.
But from this response at E3, you know, a lot of people in the industry started getting into it. And as soon as they did, Lucky started taking prototypes to other folks, like the people at Valve.
Yeah. Gabe Newell, for example.
Mm-hmm. And got people like Gabe Newell to participate in this new Kickstarter project that he was putting together for what we know as the Oculus Rift today.
Yeah, so this is really the founding of Oculus as a company. So Oculus is the company that is creating the Oculus Rift. And in fact, you can think of the Oculus Rift as being their first product. And so now the plan had changed. It was no longer going to be, let's offer up 100 dev kits that this one guy is personally putting all the pieces together, putting them in a box and shipping them off to the 100 or so people that have backed it. Now it's, let's put together a plan to create a more, a slightly, not a consumer level product, because it's still, like, if you take a look at one of the Oculus Rift headsets, it does not look like...
like a finished product.
Yeah, it's not sleek and sexy.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting to use, but when you look at it, you're like, wow, it looks like a black box that you strap to your face. It is
because
not...
because it is.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's not something that you would think, oh, this is something that you could easily market beyond this niche audience.
Right, the Kickstarter fund was for development kits.
Right. So the goal of that Kickstarter fund was exactly $250,000. $250,000. So Lauren, tell me, did they make it?
They made it times 10 approximately.
Yeah. Within 24 hours, they had already made the
goal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then went on to raise precisely $2,437,429.
Yeah. It was a lot of money they brought in. And it makes it one of Kickstarter's big success stories, right? Right up there with some of the, I mean, clearly not on the level of, say, the Pebble, but it's way up there.
Sure.
It's on the holy cow, look at what's possible end of the spectrum, as opposed to the, so that's what really happens when you launch a Kickstarter.
Yes, yeah.
Personal experience.
They wound up having 9,522 backers. Over 7,000 of those were development kit purchases.
Right. So it was only at certain levels or above that you would actually get a developer
receive kit. Receive a kit, right.
Yeah, the first 100 people to pledge at the $275 level would receive a developer kit at a discount, because mm-hmm. the developer kits in general go at $300 a pop.
Right. That's how much they're currently selling for
On their site.
On their site.
If you go to Oculus, you mm-hmm. can, by the way, if you want to, you can buy one of these.
Anyone can. You don't have to have some kind of paperwork.
You don't need to know that the password is swordfish. You know, you don't need to know.
Recommend receiving a rabies shot.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. No rabies is associated with Oculus Rift that I'm personally aware of.
So far. so far. When we get that 28 days later video game, you know, there'll be rage.
Get Matt and Ben in here.
But at any rate, yeah, get some stuff they don't want you to know in here. Plug. Yeah, the $300, so you can actually buy one of these yourself. But if you do that, knowing that your actual use of it's going to be pretty limited if you're not a developer.
Sure.
If you are a developer and you want to practice, you know, try and create stuff that works with the Oculus Rift, clearly that's an investment that would make sense for you. If you're an average gamer, unless you are intending to play one of the three titles that is currently compatible with the Oculus Rift, it doesn't make sense because it's not, like we said, it's not at consumer product level yet. This is on the way to becoming a consumer product. Yeah. So after 100 people could back at the $275 level, that was it. It was sort of an early bird special. And if you weren't part of that, then you had to go at $300 or higher to get at least one headset. At the higher levels, you could actually get more than one headset at a discount. So the solution here to creating a viable product is the partnership with developers, the partnership with game companies, because this is kind of like a specialized video display that only works with stuff that's been built to work with it. So it's not, again, it's not like you can just plug it in and run any kind of software and then you are in the middle of it.
Right,
you
know, no.
It has to be optimized for it. And mm-hmm. we'll talk more about why when we get into how it's actually working. But always important to remind people because it is an exciting thing, but I don't want everyone running out and dropping $300 and then being disappointed that they can't play, you know, Super Mario and be running through and knocking the blocks. Although that would be awesome.
That would be awesome.
Moving on. The Kickstarter campaign was a success.
We could say that. I think that's safe to say.
It's safe to call it that. And Lucky would continue to show this off at various conferences and conventions. I first heard about this when they showed it off at CES 2013. Mm-hmm. I might have heard about it once or twice beforehand, but I knew that it was present at the showroom floor at CES 2013. Unfortunately,
sure.
I didn't get a chance to play with it then.
Hmm.
I didn't get a chance to play with it until E3 2013, and then I played the heck out of it.
Right, yeah, that Kickstarter campaign had run from August to September of 2012. So yeah, so moving up to 2013 is when they were just going like, we have all the money and we have all the support and let us
and then they
frolic.
Got then they ended up getting the additional private support as well as more orders that came in after the Kickstarter was complete.
At E3 2013 they beat out both the PS4 and the Xbox One for the best hardware peripheral Game Critics Award.
Not surprising. It's got a lot of potential. And beyond the virtual reality realm, there are a lot of people who are interested in appropriating some of the same sort of technologies that Lucky used to create augmented reality headsets. So this would be more like what we hear about the potential for Google Glass or other various glasses that are supposed to incorporate augmented reality at some point. They're talking about using something along the same lines as the technology used for the Oculus Rift. Now, clearly, the way the Oculus Rift is created with these screens, these solid screens in front of your face, that's not ideal for augmented reality glasses if you're going to be moving around in the real world because you're going to see a video representation of the real world directly in front of you. I think most people would imagine that the augmented reality version would include clear display that you could see stuff printed on.
I could see a very similar set of technologies going towards that kind of display. But we'll get into
the
that.
Actual tech stuff in just
sure,
a second.
Sure, yeah.
So some other interesting developments happened. One of them absolutely tragic that happened just before E3.
Right, June 1st.
June 1st, that's when Andrew Rice, who was one of the graphics engineers, one of the original team members at Oculus, was involved in a car accident. He was, the car was fleeing a police chase when it collided with him, and he passed away as a result of that accident. And, I mean, that was obviously, this was a very tight, small development team.
Right. It's still, I believe, under 30 people.
Yeah, that's tiny
for
when you're talking about something that has...
That's raising $16 million
exactly.
And has this kind of reach.
Right, exactly. So obviously that was felt deeply within their their own company and across the community. I mean, this was the other thing about Oculus was that, and something they continue to do, they update regularly. They blog about the development process. They blog about the people involved. So there were backers who felt, you know, personal
very
connections.
Very personally, yeah.
So that was a very tragic moment.
Mm-hmm.
They also, on August 7th, so not too long before we record this podcast, we're recording this on August 15th. But on August 7th, John Carmack stopped becoming just an evangelist for the company and started to work for the company.
As the chief technology officer, in fact.
Yep, CTO. And he also is still continuing his work with other companies as well. It's not like he's quit everything just to work exclusively for Oculus. But now he is on the company payroll.
And as of July, they had 17,000 developer kits out.
Yeah.
So
they were actually delivering upon the mm-hmm. backing. That's something else I should point out, because their Kickstarter has a little bit of a, I don't know if you could say that Kickstarter has a tarnished reputation, but the idea of having a Kickstarter campaign has a little bit of a tarnished reputation, only because there have been cases, particularly when it comes to something like promising a particular type of technology, where the delivery has either been delayed or even canceled.
Right.
And it has caused people to kind of have a negative reaction to Kickstarter in general. So this is actually a positive story in the sense that here's a company that held a Kickstarter campaign.
And less than a year later, some of the hardware's out.
On it, right. Yeah.
According to their website, like yesterday, if you buy a dev kit right now, it'll be shipping sometime in September 2013.
That's a pretty quick turnaround, yeah. Considering that I'm sure this is still one of those things that doesn't have a truly seamless manufacturing process yet, because
absolutely.
It's still in the developer stage.
Yeah, yeah. And they are set to open a Dallas office very soon.
Yep.
Possibly right now.
Yeah. You know, go check. If you're in Dallas, let us know if it's open yet.
Yes.
So now let's talk about how this crazy thing works. We mentioned a little bit about it already.
Yeah. The way that you see in 3D vision with your eyeballs is that, you know, they're slightly offset. They are not in the exact same place on your face.
Because we can't be a cyclops.
Oh, you could be if you really tried.
Yeah. If misfortune befell you.
Yes. This does happen to some people. There are many medical conditions in which you only have the use of one eye. And,
right.
And that is where you do not get stereoscopic stereo, you know,
in two, yeah.
In dual, yeah. Yes. So combining two images that are very slightly offset, your brain goes, I can see this in three dimensions.
Right. So instead of us both getting two sets of images that remain two sets of images in our brains, which would be kind of an interesting experience, I'm sure, but also maybe disorienting, this two sets of data get combined into one set. And that's what we think of as the world around us as far as vision is concerned. So this helps us judge things like how close or far away an object is. There are other things that help too, like comparing the size of something. Like,
sure.
If I know that that Josh Clark is taller than Lauren, so if I look and I see that Lauren appears to be taller than Josh, I know that Josh is approximately a mile away and Lauren's probably in front of me. That's just an
That's a science fact, actually, guys.
You make old jokes, I make short jokes.
And this is also how a lot of special effects end up working by tricking your brain into thinking.
Yeah,
that
the force perspective.
Force perspective.
Yeah, so Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, obviously, those
right.
are ones that you would think about.
Hugely.
Where because
mm-hmm.
because the video itself is being shown to you on a two-dimensional, well, until we get to the 3D movies, and on a two-dimensional surface, you can trick people by having this forced perspective thing. But in an actual world situation, because you've got these converging lines of sight on objects, you can use what is called parallax. That's the idea of these two lines that eventually do converge onto something.
They
give you an idea.
Right.
Yeah. And that's your focal point. That gives you an idea of how close or far away something is. The further away an object gets, the more parallel these two lines become, so that it becomes less of a useful tool for things that are really far away. So if you're talking about two buildings that are way off in the distance, you might not be able to tell which one is larger just based on that alone. without, you know, previous knowledge of building A is twice the size of building B.
Right, right.
But if it's closer to you, parallax comes into play. So that's the idea, right? Each screen gives a slightly different view of whatever it is you're looking at in the realm of the virtual environment, which in this case are games.
Mm-hmm.
And that way it gives you the illusion that it's, that you are right there and that the world you are in actually has depth. Now, there's no eye-tracking software here, but there is head-tracking hardware.
Right.
So it's not keeping track of where your eye motions are. So you can look around. It's not like if you're wearing just goggles. The goggles themselves aren't tracking your eyes, but they will move as, you know, as you move the direction of your face. Same sort of thing. So it's using sensors to detect that kind of motion, whether it's pitch, roll, yaw, tilt, all that kind of stuff. It's detecting all of that as input for changing the way the display appears in front of you.
Mm-hmm. This display being an LCD screen in a plastic mask, it sits about an inch away from the user's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And right, that screen is divided by a small barrier. It's a pretty big screen. I think it's like 110 degrees.
Yeah,
diagonally. We'll get into that in a second.
Yeah.
But it uses a few other tricks to create realism as well. It warps slightly the edges of the images and corrects that in the goggles a little bit. So, the digital rendering, I'm saying, is warped a little bit at the edges, and then the goggles correct for it, which is basically how your eyeballs work because they're curved.
Right. The idea here being that you don't want it to just look like you
flat.
Are. Yeah, that you're looking at a flat world that has depth behind it, but there's nothing around you.
Mm-hmm. It also packs the pixels more tightly directly in front of your eyeball than around the edges, which, again, because our eyeballs are curved, it gives a human-like roundness to an image.
It also helps, you know, it keeps you motivated to focus directly straight ahead with your eyes as opposed to keeping your head still and moving your eyes around, because it's kind of mimicking that sense of when I look ahead, whatever I'm mm-hmm. looking at is in focus, and then everything else is kind of in peripheral vision.
Petering out a little
yeah.
bit, sure. There are a few limitations that are currently being addressed. There's a certain screen door effect, which in which right now users have been finding that they can see through the pixels of the LCD screen because there's not enough of them. They need more.
Needs higher resolution.
Yes. And I think that they're trying to add gaze tracking.
Which would be really interesting. That would allow you to actually, dynamically change these elements we talked about where you've got those pixels that are, concentrated right in front of the eyes. If you could be able to move that dynamically so that you would have this effect where if I'm walking and I'm not turning my head, but I dart my eyes to the left and it is able to move in real time with that. And we'll talk a little bit about prediction software in a bit that kind of helps with that. Then that could make it even more immersive.
Sure.
And feel closer to being natural. In fact, and again, while it's hard to say that being in a virtual environment is ever kind of a natural thing, after that initial adjustment, you do start to feel, you start to move within that virtual environment. You don't really necessarily think about your real world surroundings as much unless, you know, something changes that diverts your attention.
Right.
Let's say that you have a anxious Jack Russell Terrier who jumps on your lap. That might, you know, unless that also has happened at the exact same time in the video game, that could pull your attention away.
Right. Or let's say that you bang your knee into a table because you were walking forward as your character in the game
right,
walked forward.
Right. And by the way, there are people who are working on various setups that are not meant for consumer use either, but they were interested in combining the Oculus Rift with other things so that you would have even more immersive control in various games. Like there was the group that did the virtual Paperboy.
Right.
Where
right,
they
yeah.
had it hooked up to a resistance bike. Training bike where they, by pedaling the bike, they would propel the video game character forward. They had a first person perspective as if they were playing Paperboy, but from the Paperboy's point of view. And then they had a Kinect sensor
right.
detecting their arm motions to be when you fling a
mm-hmm.
newspaper. So what they did was they hooked up the Oculus Rift to an exercise bike, a resistance training bike. And by pedaling the resistance training bike,
right, right.
they propel the virtual character forward. And then they had a Kinect sensor that would detect arm motions.
So that when you throw the papers.
Yeah, that would be the indicator for the game to throw the papers. And you're seeing it all from the Paperboy's perspective as opposed to that side view that you had in the original arcade game.
Right.
So That's just one example. There are other people who have kind of developed the multi-directional treadmills so that you could walk on the treadmill and this would propel you forward within a virtual environment. So there's a lot of already, you know, a lot of talk already about incorporating the Oculus Rift into other types of setups of this nature. Now, granted, that goes beyond what the average video game player would experience.
Sure.
So we don't recommend you get up on your feet and walk around while you're wearing one of these things because you're not going to see your actual environment. You're seeing a virtual environment.
I've heard a few, you know, not sob stories, but just stories of like, caution, you can totally knock over wine glasses while you are flailing about with this thing.
It's kind of similar to the warnings you would hear from the original Wii remote,
right,
where people were flinging them into their television sets. And you would see a picture of a Wii remote emerged from an old TV set. And you think, mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wrist strap.
So,
yeah. But interestingly enough, you can still use the Oculus Rift even if you have poor or no vision in one eye.
Yep. The screen will still work.
Sure. You won't get the stereoscopic three-dimensional effect. Richard Eisenbeis, writing for Kotaku, recently described what it's like playing with a single eye because he had a bad LASIK surgery experience. But, the doctors expect full recovery. But he said that the 3D effect was slightly flattened and that his depth perception was off, like you do when you only have one eye working.
Sure.
And that motion blur was increased, but that it was still very immersive and actually didn't cause any queasiness.
Right. And, one of the big causes of queasiness is this idea of latency, which I mentioned earlier. Latency, the name kind of gives it away. What latency is it's a delay between when you take an action and when that action is displayed to you. Now, in the case of head tracking software, that would mean that if I turned my head to the right, the display would reflect that turn on the screen. But if there's a delay between when I turn my head and when it happens on the screen, my brain thinks, whoa, something is messed up, yo.
Right, because it's actually better than instantaneous when you're seeing it in real life, because your brain is filling in information that it doesn't already have yet.
Yeah. There's some predictive stuff going on in your brain already.
Mm-hmm.
It's handling a lot of input from a lot of different sources, everything
sure.
from your inner ear to what's coming into your eyes to what you're sensing, like by touch. So all of these things go into telling your brain what is going on around you. And when those things don't match up, your brain's like, something's not good. Let's trigger the stomach to empty all of its contents as rapidly as possible. Or at least that seems to be the case.
Seems like a bad reflex, but...
But if you've ever been, say, on a boat and you have that sensation of, you know, the ground you are on is moving, but because you're moving with the ground, your vision isn't reflecting that, right? You're not, especially if you're on the inside of a boat and you can't see the outside at all. Your brain is just saying, this is weird because everything, it looks still from my perspective, but I'm feeling like you're moving all over the place. Let's turn on the vacate the stomach flip switch and see
maybe,
what happens.
Maybe that'll make it better.
You're right. Somehow that'll fix things. I don't understand the physiological part of this, but this is what seems to happen. So
let's get Robert and Julie on that one while we're plugging other shows.
Yeah. Stuff to blow your mind. Listen to it. It's awesome. But yeah, this idea of the mismatched data that comes into you, it often ends up making you feel dizzy, nauseous, or nauseated, I should say. I mean, you might be nauseous as well, but nauseated. It's unpleasant. And so latency is a big, big contributor to that. So getting latency down where there is as little delay as possible is a goal. Now, Oculus says that they developed a reduced latency technology that got it down to 2 milliseconds to send the information from the headset to the software. Now, that's a one-way trip there. Remember, there's a round trip that we have to take into account here. It's not just the trip to the software. The software has to crunch the numbers from whatever data it's receiving and send back the appropriate response to the screen. So it takes longer than 2 milliseconds for all that to happen. And humans can detect a latency of around 50 milliseconds, maybe even fewer than 50 milliseconds. That's no time at all. I mean, we're talking a fraction of a second. Now, according to Steve Lavelle, using the Rift and playing a game at 60 frames per second, latency is right around 30 to 50 milliseconds. So just right below or at that threshold.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes the time it takes for the sensors to pick up the motion, send that motion out the port, go into the game engine as a command, and then get rendered.
Render and come back.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the full trip. That's the whole round trip. And if it's able to do that reliably at that speed, that's good. And we, you know, I expect that that's something that they're going to work on improving to make sure that there is as little latency issue there as possible, especially as video games start to push that limit of 60 frames per second. If they are pushing to make it even more frames per second, then clearly you have to worry about that latency issue because that's more data that's going through these ports. Like we said, the sensors, the motion sensors, detect yaw, pitch, and roll, and they use what is called sensor fusion, which is not a type of cuisine, as I first thought, but it's actually a technique to combine all the data that's gathered from these various sensors into virtual actions within the context of the environment you're in, the game you are in. And then Steve Lavelle also wrote an incredible blog post that is really, really technical. If you are interested on the software side of this, and about how to reduce latency to the minimum levels, I highly recommend it because it's fascinating, but it's way too technical for us to go into here. But this is where he was talking about predictive techniques. So prediction is exactly what it sounds like. The game engine starts to predict what you are going to do based upon what you are doing right now.
Oh, wow. And so it starts to render out what you're going to need to see next before you actually need it.
And the goal of this is not to give you a vision of the future, but rather to remove that latency, to make it as small as possible. So if the predictive techniques are good, then it means that you have a very smooth experience, very little motion blur, no latency. If it's bad, it means that, like, if you suddenly turn left, but it starts to go right because it thought you were going to go right, then that's going to just exacerbate the problem. So predictive technology has to be really sophisticated for it to do more good than harm. His blog post goes into great detail about how they are using this to try and create a really immersive, comfortable experience with the Oculus Rift. And like I said, it's really, really great. The Oculus blogs in general, fantastic read, but they are very technical. So read at your own risk.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
So let's talk about what the actual hardware has. So according to what's in the developer kit right now.
Right.
Keeping in mind the consumer version is going to be different from what is out there right now.
It will very likely change indeed.
Yep.
So we've got 6 degrees of freedom.
Right.
That pitch roll and yaw. Yeah.
Yep.
For the head tracking. That 110 degree diagonal screen.
Yep.
That we were talking about, which is, 90 degrees horizontal.
Yep. 90 degrees horizontal field of view. So, you know, the screens are physically, they're small, but because of their proximity to your eyeballs, they look pretty big. It fills your vision.
It's a DVI video input.
Yep. Digital visual interface input. This was that input interface, by the way, was originally developed by the Display Working Group. That's the kind of interface that allows you to hook up a display to a computer. So a lot of computer monitors and displays have this.
Mm-hmm. However, it does have HDMI adaptation.
Yeah,
capacity.
Yeah. You can get an HDMI adapter to convert from DVI to HDMI, but you do need to have that adapter. Natively, it does not have an HDMI port to hook up.
Right.
But that's one thing I expect the consumer version would have just because of the drive to move to HDMI.
Yes.
Especially since a lot of video game consoles have that kind of thing. I expect that we will see HDMI native support in whatever the consumer version is. They haven't announced that, so don't take that as, you know, gospel.
Right. Don't quote us on
that. That's just my prediction. Yeah, so you need to have either HDMI or DVI video out on your
computer in order to run this.
Yeah, if you were like, but my computer only has FireWire.
It is for PC only right now.
Yep.
They are, again, hoping to roll it out to consoles and mobile platforms. They're also talking, there's buzz anyway, that they're talking about expanding it to watching movies, surfing the web, doing programming.
Yeah, which...
In the Matrix!
Yeah. All right, Lawnmower Man. It just shows our own frames of reference for virtual environments, doesn't it? You say Matrix, I say Lawnmower Man. Oy. I wonder about watching movies because, again, at that point, you're not really even talking about head tracking, right? There's no purpose for head tracking if you're watching a film because the film is captured from a single point of view. I mean, unless you're presenting only part of a movie screen, which I can't imagine being a satisfying experience, you're really just looking at something really close to your face. Unless you eventually get to a point where you are able to create especially if it's a 3D animated movie, then this would be much easier to do. You could create a movie where you would be able to change your perspective as opposed to relying upon the camera to define what the perspective is.
Sure. Or just even I think, you know, if you've got one of the digital 3D stereoscopic films that you just pour. I mean, even without being able to move your head around, it would
be. I could see that. Where you're talking about maybe watching movies that were designed to be in 3D in the first place. Maybe this would give a superior 3D experience.
Yeah.
I could see that.
And also it reduces eye strain from looking at a 3D screen because the way that these goggles work is you're actually focusing on you're relaxing your eyes to a distant point.
Right. You're kind of looking through the screen.
Which is the default for your eyes looking. It's any kind of eye strain that you get, you would think, you know, oh, it's an inch away from your eye, that's gonna lead to terrible eye strain, but actually looking at your computer screen a foot away from you causes a lot more eye strain than these goggles would.
The idea being that this is like looking through a window as opposed to
But anyway.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So the
about that screen. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's currently 1280 by 800.
But that's if you combine the two screens, right?
Right. It's what's that? 640 by 800 per eye?
Yeah. Yep. 640 by 800 per eye, which is that's close to the resolution of 720p, which is 1280 by 720.
Okay. But again, this is a thing that could change for consumers.
Right. And also, I mean, you know, obviously higher resolution means better pictures in general, but there's also something you need to consider that the closer you get to a screen, the less resolution matters, right? So unless your screen is getting larger and larger and larger. So let's say you've got, you stay with let's say that your TV is 40 inches, right? depending upon how close you sit to that television, 720p and 1080p might not be that distinguishable. Now, if you sit closer and closer to it, then you're going to notice. If you sit further away, those differences fade away into nothing. So that you could have a 720p and a 1080p set side by side, but if you're 15 feet back, they look the same, assuming they've both been calibrated for that room and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about an 80-inch screen, first of all, invite me over because I want to watch movies and play Halo. Then it obviously will matter more. You've got more screen space. The resolution is spread out over a greater landscape area. So you've got to, have higher resolution or else you will start to notice it at regular viewing distances. With something that's 1 inch away from your eye, while they could probably increase the resolution and it would be maybe noticeable, I don't know that they have to stress it too much.
Oh, right. I think mostly the issue right now is that screen door effect that I was talking about earlier.
Exactly. Yeah.
The headset itself weighs a little bit less than half a pound or a little bit less than a quarter of a kilogram.
Yeah. Nice. So it's not too terribly heavy. Another huge advance over older VR software or hardware, I should say.
Anything that you're strapping to your head. Nice to have it light. Yes. And the dev kits right now cost $300 a pop.
Right.
I've heard that they're trying to keep it with the final commercial product within the $300 to $500 range.
Which, you know, when you're considering that most consoles cost around that much, makes sense. They don't want it to go higher than the console that it would
work
with.
Sure. And it's still a significant improvement over, again, the $1,000 or so a pop that current.
Or the $100,000 if you're talking about the specifically made for the VR industry equipment that was back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's not like it's not going to be inexpensive. It's going to be an expensive peripheral. Now, if you're used to either building or buying high end video game rigs, this is, you know, just a small expense compared to what your $10,000 rig was. So this kit is not just the hardware. There's the software developer kit too. So this is the software side. And again, remember, Lucky is not a software guy. He's a hardware guy. The software developer kit contains all the information you would need to be able to develop stuff specifically to display on an Oculus Rift and to work with this motion tracking hardware. And that contains all the libraries you need, the headers, the documentation, the samples for integrating the Rift with games. It also includes two different game engines, the Unreal Engine and the Unity engines. And those are widely available game engines that a lot of companies use as the basis for the physics and number crunching engine of whatever game they're running. So there are currently three titles that are compatible with the Oculus Rift. One of them is Team Fortress 2, which is a squad-based first-person shooter game, moves at an incredibly frenetic pace. The other one that was originally announced as being compatible was Hawken, which is a multiplayer mech combat video game by Adhesive Games.
The third that they just rolled out, I think in August of 2013, right before we recorded this podcast, was Half-Life 2. Because I do not at all want the experience of having a head crab jump at my face having it be more realistic.
But don't you want the experience of watching a gravity gun work right in front of your face and launching things at high velocity? Also, I mean, that gives me hope that the next title will be Portal. Can you imagine Portal first person? Like you are in the world of Portal? That's what I'm waiting on. Because those two universes are connected.
They
Aperture
are.
Science and Black Mesa.
And Black Mesa, as we all know from the Jonathan Coulton song.
They are connected.
Completely connected.
So come on guys, let's get our Oculus Rift version of Portal.
That sounds a little bit sickening, but wonderful.
I would love it. I don't know what that would be like once you start moving at those insane speeds where you do the vertical portals.
I would need to get one of those psychologists to come to my house while I played so that I could turn it into a height therapy related.
I can imagine that. Yeah, maybe that game wouldn't work out in the long run. I'd be willing to play it until I started.
I want that right now, but I'm terrified.
But those are the titles available right now. Not Portal, but Half-Life 2, Team Fortress 2, and Hawken. So we'll see those expand, obviously. But even so, like, again, just to stress yet again, this is, of course, the developer side. once this becomes a consumer product, I would expect there to be support for at least 20 titles.
Yeah.
Because if there's not, then, you know, it's hard to justify the expense in the mind of the gamer. Like, I'm willing to pay $300 to $500 on this piece of technology and I can play 20 games on it and that's it. Or not fewer than 20.
Fewer, yeah, right.
That would be a
If you can only do less than 10, then that might be a, like, why would I pay that much money for that thing? Although lots of people are excited about it. There is no official release date.
Yep. Yeah, the company's stance is it'll be ready when it's ready, which is, I think, the most responsible way to go about it. Because otherwise, what you'll do is you'll create a deadline that, you know, something will pop up that you could not have anticipated that will either cause you to miss the deadline, thus inviting the ire of all of the internets, or you will start to sacrifice things in order to make the original deadline and the product will be less than what it could have been. So I think that taking this approach of we aren't announcing a date, we're getting it as soon as possible, but we want it to be good when it launches, I think that's the right choice, especially when you're talking about hardware. Because, I mean, you can't, it's harder to update that. I mean, you can do firmware updates, obviously, but,
sure.
but once you put the pieces in place,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's harder. Yeah.
Yep.
Like we said, there's no official price yet either. You know, obviously they want to keep it affordable.
Yep. And we might see it being used in, well, I'm sure we'll see it being used in virtual reality fields beyond gaming.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the kind of stuff that they're talking about it being useful for, like surgery training.
Right.
Or architecture and design.
Which is really kind of cool. This idea of being able to take a virtual tour of a building that hasn't even gone beyond the blueprint stage.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of interesting. And, of course, the medical techniques that we've talked about already, this exposure technique.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the VR industry still exists, although they call it virtual environments for the most part. It still exists, but they do go to the video game industry all the time for all the equipment. So I expect we'll see that continue. All right, so that was the story as far as it had progressed in August of 2013. But back in March of 2014, there was an event that really shook up the whole Oculus VR world.
Wii news item.
Yeah, it sent ripples throughout the force. Like the destruction of Dantooine. Yeah, it was Dantooine. No, it wasn't Dantooine. It was Alderaan, right?
Because yeah.
Dantooine was too far for an effective demonstration. But anyway. So, yes, there was this big event. That big event, of course, was when the company Facebook decided it wanted the Oculus VR company.
And furthermore, that it wanted it $2 billion worth.
And so they said, hey, we'll give you $2 billion to come and join the dark side. And they said, sure. No, I'm just being silly. I don't think Facebook is the dark side necessarily. But this announcement was met with some pretty extreme responses on either side of the spectrum. Right?
Yeah, there was a lot of enthusiasm.
Yeah, because it meant that Oculus Rift now had an enormous safety net. I mean,
the R&D money that they could possibly want.
A multi-billion dollar company supporting them.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't like let's say that their hardware implementation didn't work out the way they had planned. As a small company that was dependent upon investment, it might not have been able to bounce back from something like this. But with this big company, they can afford to take risks, right? So that's
a big
thing.
However, there was also a certain amount of trepidation.
Yeah, because you know, let's face it, Facebook is in the business of collecting all of the data about you.
Right.
I mean,
the service is free because we are the product.
Exactly. If you are using Facebook, you are a product that is being sold. And I mean, that's the way Facebook generates revenue. If it didn't do that, then Facebook couldn't stick around. So
not without forcing us to pay them.
Yeah. So that's the other side of the coin, right? So some people, like Minecraft creator Notch, posted a tweet that said he would no longer want to develop a build for Minecraft for the Oculus Rift because he found Facebook to be creepy. So that, you know.
Yeah, there was a lot of pushback, especially among, I think, the hardcore fans of the Rift.
Yeah. And remember, you know, the Oculus Rift also was just going to be a dedicated PC device, computer device, not a console related device. So that raises a question. What does Facebook have planned for the Oculus Rift? Well, one thing that executives have said, and this is something that blows my mind. I mean, It's hard for me to imagine what would be required to pull this off, but they envision a virtual world with 1 billion people in it.
Oof, which is essentially Facebook's user base.
Yeah. When they hit 1 billion unique users, or at least unique accounts,
yeah.
We don't know necessarily.
It's a significant difference, I suspect.
I'm sure there are quite a few duplicate, there are people who are using different accounts. But anyway, 1 billion users, more or less, and then putting them in this virtual environment as some way of communicating and making a social platform that is completely immersive. That's
huge.
Hard to imagine.
Yeah. I mean, I'm picturing something like was described in Snow Crash.
Yeah. I'm just picturing like a busiest day ever at Disney World and you're just completely surrounded. I mean, obviously, if you're creating a virtual environment, you can create as much space or as little space as you want. So assuming you have the computer power to support it. But it does make me wonder when we would see such an implementation. Obviously, in order for it to be 1 billion users, you would also need to sell 1 billion units of Oculus Rift, and I don't think that's going to happen.
Oh, yeah, that's a sky-high dream.
Yeah. But still, the idea of
using
it...
Even if you could have enough servers to... Oh, yeah, there's a lot of issues that you would need to work out there.
There's some steps between where we are and where they want to be. But there's some other issues that we have to mention, too. After the acquisition announcement, a company called ZeniMax Media, which used to be the employer of one Mr. John Carmack, you know, because he was working for id Software. Id Software is a subsidiary of ZeniMax Media. Well, the company filed a lawsuit against Oculus VR, and they said that the Rift was based at least in part off of the VR work done within ZeniMax, and it also relied upon the expertise of Carmack.
Including several systems that Carmack had designed for ZeniMax projects during his time there.
Yeah. And apparently, depending upon who you ask, they had some conversations about this.
ZeniMax claims that it tried to work all of this proprietary stuff out with Oculus after Oculus's big Kickstarter success proved that they would be actually bringing a device to market. But that Oculus first failed to respond, then offered ZeniMax what they considered an unfair equity share, only 3%, which was $1.2 million at the time, or some $60 million after Facebook's purchase, not that they knew that was going to happen,
right.
Which ZeniMax claims that they countered, and furthermore claims that Oculus refused, thereby pressing ZeniMax into this lawsuit.
Now, Oculus VR, on their part, they said that, that ZeniMax's demands were outrageous, that mm-hmm. they were asking for way too much. And two said that there was no technology from ZeniMax included in the Oculus Rift at all. And they also implied that it was pretty convenient that the lawsuit only came out after Facebook acquired Oculus. In other words, after
they had all the money.
Yeah, this enormous cash flow went into the company. So
to be fair, there is some potential evidence available even to the public. For example, a tweet from John Carmack in April 2014, which said, and I quote, "When you are in a hurry and you know you wrote the exact needed code well at a previous job, reimplementation grates."
Yeah. But on the other hand, they also point out that the Oculus Rift SDK was publicly available and doesn't have a single line of ZeniMax code in it. So, you know, there's a lot of conflicting information. The lawsuit is currently being considered, so you know, we don't have any results for that.
Certainly not yet.
We
will not rerun this episode again, but
no.
We will try to update you guys when that comes to a head.
Maybe we'll just do an episode where, hey, guess what? It's just a bunch of updates on a bunch of unrelated things. Here are 50 topics we've talked about in the past. And 2 sentences updating on each of them.
Oh, why did you? That's a terrible number.
No,
never talk about.
It would be a pretty awful episode, too. It would be the most non sequitur filled episode we've ever done. And we've done some doozies.
Uh-huh.
But also back in March 2014, another thing happened that excited folks. Oculus unveiled the DK2 developer headset. So keep in mind, all the headsets the Oculus Rift has produced so far have been for developers who want to create games or other applications using the headset.
Mm-hmm.
There are no consumer versions of the hardware on the market yet.
Nope.
But this one increased the resolution of the 2 screens inside the headset to 960 by 1080. They are OLED screens, and they are supposed to reduce motion blur and also increase clarity, color, and contrast, the 3 big C's that you want with your screens.
It also includes a external camera,
yep,
which is designed to help the headset track your head movements, giving the wearer the ability to like look out over a ledge or around a corner.
Yeah, or underneath a table.
Mm-hmm.
So because the external camera can track the orientation of the user's head in relation to their real world environment,
uh-huh,
it can translate into the perspective you would need in the virtual environment to mimic that motion. So if I were to walk up to a table in a game and I wanted to look underneath it to see if there were any clues, I could actually squat down, bend my head over, and because the external camera could track how my head was changing in orientation in respect to my real environment, I get that reflected in the virtual one. Pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And there was some talk for a while about whether or not the DK2 would incorporate this. They showed it off at CES,
mm-hmm,
and there wasn't any guarantee that the DK2 would have it. There's still not a guarantee that the consumer model, once it comes out, will have it, but there's a lot of hope because it does add to the...
Significantly improve the experience, sure.
Exactly. Now, other companies have also announced since the time we did that podcast that they are going to launch their own competing headsets.
Mm.
The two big ones would be Sony, which has the device called the Morpheus in development. Obviously, that would be important because, again, the Oculus Rift is meant for PCs. If you wanted to have something that had a console experience, you would have to go somewhere else. And so Sony's approach is the Morpheus. Then you also have Samsung getting into this. They have produced a prototype headset, and they have not, at least as far as I can tell, there's been no release of an actual name for the prototype. They do hope to bring it out to market before either Morpheus or Oculus Rift go to the consumer market.
Oh,
so
wow.
They're really fast-tracking this to try and beat them to the punch.
Huh.
So it'll be exciting to see what happens.
Yeah, definitely. Meanwhile, there are some more serious applications of this technology.
Yeah, we're talking military applications. Mm-hmm. And so here in the United States, DARPA is using the Oculus Rift to help train soldiers in new techniques to fight cyber warfare. I read this story 3 times from Wired, called DARPA is using Oculus Rift to prep for cyber war. And I don't get it. The idea is that they would actually be able to visualize things like a cyber attack on a network. So if you remember like any movie from the 1980s where you have a hacker try to hack a system, half the time it would show a 3D first person shooter kind of model where you're going through a maze and then you see a skull and crossbones like, oh, you don't want to go through there, hacker. Take the door to the right, which for some reason isn't protected. And that's how you hack into the system because Hollywood wanted to have a visually entertaining way to represent this process.
Right.
Never mind the fact that hacking doesn't involve wandering through first-person shooter kind of environments, except now it totally could, which is weird.
So it's making all of our 1980s dreams come true.
Yeah, well, most of them. I've got a couple that, you know, I still don't have my DeLorean. But anyway, pretty awesome, interesting implementation. Have no idea if it's ever going to catch on, but it is an interesting approach. Then you also have another one. This is the Norwegian army looking into using the Oculus Rift to improve the situational awareness of people who are inside tanks. Now, as you can imagine, operating inside a tank, which is designed to protect the crew as much as possible.
It doesn't have a whole lot of windows.
Yeah. You don't want a lot of views to the outside world in a heavily armored vehicle. It tends to be a point of vulnerability. So the way some of these tanks work is that they have cameras mounted on the outside. And usually what you would have to do is you have a monitor and you would switch between camera feeds to see what was going on around the perimeter of the tank. Now, this is important for you to be able to assess the situation, see if there are any enemies or even friendlies near you, because obviously, you know, you're in an enormous vehicle. You have to be careful. Well, what they're looking at is using the cameras, these 4 cameras that would be mounted to the outside of tanks, and digitally stitching together all the camera feeds, because when you add all of them together, you get a full 360-degree field of view around the tank. So if you digitally stitch them together and then feed that through the headset, by sitting down and facing forward in respect to the tank, so you're facing the front of the tank, you would be looking forward. If you turned your head to the right, it would start to pan your view over to the feed that's coming from the right side.
Oh, wow.
And you could do that in 360 degrees.
So you're creating a hypothetically real-time digital world that's actually the real world surrounding you.
Yeah. So it's really more of a video feed than a virtual representation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're actually seeing the what's really out there, but you're doing it as if there isn't an enormous tank all the way around you, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I think that would also take some getting used to because your perspective would be that you are the size of a tank. Because when you look around, like the thing that's in front of you and the thing that's behind you, obviously that would be separated by the length of the tank.
Oh, yeah. That's got to cause some cognitive dissonance there.
Yeah. There's probably some training you have to do in order to really get good at it. But that's super cool use of this technology, too. I mean, obviously, I want to see uses that don't necessarily involve warfare.
That would also be cool.
But anything that can improve people's ability to have situational awareness in various types of scenarios to me is an interesting application of something that's meant to be for playing games.
Yeah.
This is something we see over and over with virtual environment technology in general. We see a lot of repurposing. Either we see it repurposed from some other field to be in virtual environments, or we see virtual environment technology repurposed for some other industry.
Oh, sure. And hey, since military funding does frequently jumpstart a given technology, mm-hmm. maybe it's good that these kind of projects are going on right now.
That's true. All right. So that wraps up this update to the Oculus Rift. If you guys have any suggestions for future episodes, let us know. Send us a message. Our email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. Or drop us a line on Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter. Our handle is TechStuffHSW. When we come back, we will be running new episodes. This, for interest of full disclosure, if you were wondering, why are you doing updates? Well, two reasons. One, we wanted to update these episodes.
They really did seem like interesting news stories that we wanted to tell you guys about.
And two, I was not in the office, so we had to do something since
See,
I wouldn't be able to record.
Yes, podcast hosts are humans too.
Yeah.
I mean most of the time.
Right. Yeah. No, there are times where I doubt my own humanity, not to mention the humanity of some of our coworkers.
But we do in fact enjoy taking vacations now and then. So
at least the taking part. The preparing for can be somewhat of a toil.
Yes.
But no, we, of course, love all you guys. So let us know what you want to hear. And
Yes. We
will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit nfl.com/schedule-release to learn more.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.